Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Ciao, bienvenuti a MASHcast. Tu scioce analisa e celebrata, episodio dopo episodio, le più grand TV di tutti I tempi, MASH, trasmessa su CBS dal 1972 al 1983. Orgoglioso membro della FNW Network, sono il vostro conduttore generale Robert Iron Guts Kelly. Con noi questa settimana nella tenda VIP OE e Promario Cicurgio Dr. Ange.
Buongiorno.
E il generale Scott X.
Slancha, dear listener.
I have to say, guys, I'm impressed with myself. I got through that in one take. So
I'm impressed with you too, Rob. It was impressive. Of course, that probably occurred, Rob, because you've been off the booze, I'm sure. Your clear-mindedness really helped with that.
I can't tell if that's an Irish or Italian joke. We're here for the sixth,
yes.
Talk about the 16th episode of Season 8, Bottle Fatigue. The original air date was January 7th, 1980, written by Tad Mumford and Dan Wilcox, directed by Burt Metcalf. So, boys, again, thank you both for doing this. Ange, you know, we do the ones with Dr. Chris Lewis that are medically specific or very heavy, you know, medically heavy. But this was something we talked about, I think, years ago, because as Italian, by the way, my name, you wouldn't necessarily know that I'm half Italian by my name and how I look, because I look totally Irish and Aryan and whatever. But I am half Italian. Ange, what is the percentage we got going on with you? Are you a whole 100% or what is that?
I'm 100% Italian American. I can trace my families back pretty far.
Wow. Okay. And one thing that Italians love is making fun of other Italians. Like, we just love that. We, you know, I love the guy. I just saw The Godfather Part II over the weekend, and I loved all the Italian and anti-Italian stuff in that movie. We just really enjoy it. And so, Scott, you have some Irish in you. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. I am probably a quarter or so Irish, mostly German Irish. I have absolutely no Italian in me. So, okay. Is the difference from you guys.
Well, then, you know, as everyone on this podcast gets a drive-by by Winchester in this episode, which is very, very funny. And one of the things we'll examine when we get into it is how much of it are we laughing at Winchester for making those things, and how much are we laughing by Winchester? Like, are we just laughing at some of the stuff that he says? I don't know. Sometimes it's a little hard to guess. But anyway, you guys have both been on the show multiple times, so let's get right to the plot synopsis. So after a session in OR, all of the staff wander into the O Club, where Igor is waiting to hand out their bar tabs. Hawkeye's is almost $40, a staggering sum and far way higher than everyone else's. Hawkeye is so shocked he decides then and there to stop drinking. After earning a round of laughter from everyone, he insists it's not forever, just for a week, just to prove to himself that he can do it. Scared he's going to go home and set up a still in my living room, he says he's serious. Meanwhile, Winchester gets a letter from his sister Honoria, who announces that she's engaged to an Italian man. Winchester's bigoted snobbery kicks into high gear, furious over the idea that the woman of such breeding as his sister is engaged to someone so far below her social class. He tries placing a call home, but is rebuffed by Sparky. He then asks Colonel Potter for an emergency trip home, but of course is refused. During the first few days of Hawkeye's sobriety, he is full tilt, annoying, and sanctimonious, driving everyone crazy. Winchester is no better, deciding to get drunk every night to deal with the pain over the mere idea of Honoria marrying an Italian, resorting to all sorts of derogatory stereotypes and referring to his future brother-in-law. Hawkeye has a date with a new nurse, Lieutenant Mendenhall, but he quickly ruins it by making snide comments about her drinking. Lieutenant Mendenhall storms off in disgust. Winchester is also making things worse for himself. When discussing his problem with Father Mulcahy, he admits that at least Honoria isn't marrying an Irishman, leading Mulcahy to also storm off in disgust. Later, Winchester gets another letter from Honoria saying that the engagement is off at the behest of the groom, whose family refused to let him marry out of their faith. Wounded then arrive, and one of Hawkeye's patients is a North Korean soldier who smuggled in a live grenade. Before anyone can stop him, he pulls the pin. Hawkeye grabs the soldier's hand, keeping him from letting go of the grenade. While trying to find the pin somewhere on the floor, everyone tries to soothe the patient by singing to him. It works long enough for Mulcahy to find the pin and put it back on the grenade. Afterwards, Winchester dictates a telegram to Honoria. Reflecting on what just happened, he apologizes for the boorish letters she's about to receive. Asking for forgiveness, he pleads for her to attribute them to greatness of distance and narrowness of mind. Later that night, in the Oak Club, they all buy a drink from Mulcahy to thank him for finding the pin. They all order a drink for themselves, including Hawkeye, who says he needs it to calm himself after the near-death experience they all just had. Holding the drink in his hand, he pauses and then puts it down, saying, "I'll be back when I want it, not when I need it." All right, Scott, let's start with you before we get into the details of this episode. And we don't have to get into the specifics of it. I'm just sort of curious because I have my own thing. Is there anything that you've had in your life that it could be something not good for you or something, you know, kind of harmless, but nevertheless, something that you have found yourself like, boy, I consume a lot of this thing. And it maybe that's not good for me, like soda, candy. Is there anything like that where you've ever noticed that in your life where you're like, huh, it's getting a little, maybe this isn't great for me kind of thing?
Well, when you were talking about consuming, if you weren't going to go a food route, I was going to say comic books. I got this boxes upon boxes of, in these things. I've been trying to reorganize and bag and board. And I'm thinking, is this really good for me or not? But as far as food goes, I don't know that I've really had anything like that. I'm not really. I think I probably eat too much pizza. It's probably okay. Sort of my go-to comfort food. It's easy. It's quick. So probably that. But other than that, I wouldn't say I really do have much. Anything like that? No.
Well, let's talk about the comic books because Ange can certainly relate to that. How many comics are we talking about now, Scott? How many do you have? Do you think?
Well, I think my last count, I have about 75 long boxes.
Whoa!
My storeroom here.
Wow. Oh my! No. So okay, for people listening who may not be comic book people, a long box is this cardboard box that our standard collectors wear for anyone who collects comics, and you can fit. What? How many comics fit in a long box, guys?
It depends on if they're bagged and boarded, but probably what, Ange? 250, 300?
I was going to say probably around 200, assuming they're all the standard, you know, floppies and no big trades or you know, square box stuff.
That is more than I thought you were going to say.
Again, now you know where I said that it's unhealthy at some point. There.
Again, it could be anything, right? It doesn't have to be food. It could be just anything that you've ever in your life gone, geez, I feel like I lean in on this a little harder than I necessarily plan to. Ange, do you have anything like that?
Well, you know, I will say that I have probably about 35 long boxes that are the official collection, which is the bagged and boarded, but I also have like 7 like stuff that I bought out of the dollar box that's just like beat up to like read whenever I can. So for sure, I have a lot of comic books. And the thing is, I go to the comic book store to get my weekly stuff, and I still look in the dollar box, and I'm like, dude, but I can't help myself. I will also say I lost a fair amount of weight probably about 7 or 8 years ago. And part of that was I went to the doctor and stood on the scale and saw a number that I probably shouldn't see. And then you take a look back in life and you're like, maybe you don't need to go through the McDonald's drive-through after the ER shift at 2 a.m. and order a crap ton of food, right? Or after a long shift, go to the CVS before you get in the car and like eat a whole bag of Chex Mix while you're battling traffic. So there was a little bit too much food in my life at one point, and I was able to sort of turn that around.
That does sort of fall into that idea of the want and the need, though, right? Do you really need it? But just at that moment, you're tired, you're worn out. You're hungry. I just feel like I need this to get through this next moment.
Yes.
But that's it, it's not necessary really.
That's right. And that's the crux of it, right? Is the need versus the want. If you want it, okay. But once you're saying you need it, then that's when, you know, you start saying, oh, well, hold on. You know, I shouldn't be having that approach to it. I get that Hawkeye's dilemma here of like, and we'll get to it in a moment, but the whole idea where they say to him, oh, our drinking will go back to normal when we go home. And he's like, how do you know that? I've never gone home from a war before. And I think that's a great insight that he's like, maybe this is going to become a habit that I don't like. And personally for me, the one, I don't drink soda. I don't drink any of that kind of stuff. But the one beverage I drink are these things called, they're called the brand is called Bai, BAI, and they're like coconut flavored water, and they don't have any sugar in them, and they don't have all they're supposedly kind of healthy, but I drink way too many of them. And I know that if I go a long period of time without having one, I get irritated. And I'm like, that's not good, right? I should probably not have that reaction, because I'm like, is there something in there that's creating an addiction? I don't think that's good. And I'm like, if I go, if the store just doesn't, is out of them for a while, I just get like, okay, all right. You know, like, that's not, I don't think that's a great. So I'm trying to deal with that.
I did find it interesting that when that started out, Hawkeye, he came to that conclusion where, like you said, is this really good? Am I going to keep doing this? But the impetus for him to stop drinking was the bill. Mm-hmm. it wasn't really that mindedness at first. It was like $38.
Yeah, it was just the bill, right? That they handed him the bill.
I can't, you know, I could just, what do you say? I could have saved up and bought a Studebaker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so that was his first impetus. But then as he goes through it, I think he thinks more about it and then gets to the point where you said about the wanting and the needing and reliance.
By the way, the bill is $38, which is $510 today. So that does seem like a pretty stiff bar tab over the period of time. But I have a question. Why? Why are there bar tabs? Why does the O Club charge? Does it have to turn a profit? Isn't this just part of like special services that the Army provides? It's not like, now Rosie, we get why Rosie charges. It's an independent business. But why does the O Club, they don't charge in the mess tent. So what's it like? The booze is coming from the Army. It's not like they're getting it from some other. This is all done through official channels. This is presumably done to provide something for the troops. So why are there bar tabs at all? I guess you want to keep from people from being hammered and free liquor, but it was weird to me that there's bar tabs at all.
Yeah, that's the way that I always thought it was, that it was, how do we make sure that people, like, if you have access to free liquor, who wouldn't be hammered all the time, right? Or some people would do that. So some sort of way to rein people in.
Yeah, in other wars, and I don't know about Korean War, but they had rations, right? It was a rationed amount of whiskey that you would get, along with maybe a cigarette ration or a
See, now that makes ration. Sense.
And right? then if you wanted more, then, and particularly officers, I don't even know if enlisted men would have had the opportunity to buy, but officers then would have the opportunity to buy more if they so chose.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? To ration it, just to say, we can have this much, you can have this much, and that's it. You know, the way they did, like in World War II, right? You had like the ration, you know, you can get so much bread, you can get so much this.
Right.
But it just never really fully made any sense to me that they charge it all. Because again, the O Club does not have to turn a profit. What's the, it's not a business. It's on the base, whatever. Okay, fine. So anyway, everybody wanders in from the OR and they're all drinking, and Hawkeye is the only one that's a little perturbed by this, and they're making fun of him. And here's that line you mentioned, Scott, about, I could have bought a Studebaker. And BJ says, big deal. He would have just driven it to some bar. And, but, you know, he's like, and then of course, Hawkeye's like, what about Rosie's? What about the still? And then Winchester has the line about, my own alcohol consumption has elevated since I landed in this leper colony. It'll all go back to normal. And Hawkeye's like, how do you know that? I don't. I've never gone home from a war before. How do I know I won't set up a still in my own living room? And, you know, that's valid, right? It's a good thing for him to kind of have that realization. Now, of course, again, as you mentioned, Scott, it comes to him because of the bar tab. But nevertheless, hey, whatever, however it's
got to start somewhere.
Yeah. Now, his friends do not help him by laughing at him when he says, I'm not going to. I know that seems a little like an extreme reaction, but, you know, come on, try and support him a little bit. But they're all sort of openly mocking him to his face. I don't know.
Yeah, and even Margaret, who is somewhat supportive, you know, I've noticed you've bent an elbow a lot. I'll have a double scotch. You know, so right away, they're sort of reinforcing their own issues, even though they're maybe arguing against it at the same time.
And like BJ's line where he says, I quit. When Hawkeye's like, you want to join me? And BJ's like, I quit drinking when I was, I quit not drinking when I was a kid. It's just great.
It has been one of those things that I think we've mentioned even in other episodes where it's, how can these guys be even hammered at any point if they have no idea when wounded are coming? Right. So, I do find it, I always find it a little bit interesting that I mean, he does say, and I do think that the thing that struck me here was that he talks about the still and Rosie's and this bar tab, which, by the way, is almost twice what BJ's is, which right. just means he is consuming an awful lot of alcohol right. for sure.
You hope he's being a good guy and buying drinks for other people, but it didn't sound like that when they were talking in the the conversation in the bar there.
It doesn't make any sense to me that his bar tab would be that much more than BJ's, right? Like, well, how much is Hawkeye drinking by himself in the Oak Club without BJ? I don't know. That doesn't make any sense to me, but okay, whatever. Or maybe they're ordering different drinks or whatever.
Plot-related drinking. That's
plot-related drinking. So, okay, that's fine. And yeah, as you say, Ange, it's like it never made a lick of sense that they could allow any of the doctors to get hammered, because true wounded could arrive at any moment. I mean, there is no night staff of the 477th, despite that there probably should be. There isn't. And so, yeah, you can't afford to have your chief surgeon be soused ever. But nevertheless, you know. Okay,
and your CO. I mean,
and your CO, yeah, and your main thoracic Potter's surgeon.
Right in there,
right?
With
yeah.
them, too. Yeah.
Anybody. And your head nurse, or any of it. Doesn't make any sense. So, anyway, Hawkeye says, I'm not going to quit. I'm just going to quit for full time. Just going to quit for a week just to prove that I can do it, which is great. It's it's a noble effort. So the next morning, of course, Hawkeye is bright and bushy-tailed. He's up early in the morning. He's singing incredibly loudly. Alan Alda does not sing well on purpose. he cannot really carry. He's like sort of off key the whole time, and he's sort of screaming when he's singing. Now, Ange, if you wouldn't mind sharing some of your medical knowledge here, what is the physical transformation that the body goes under when you stop drinking? What is it about drinking that's dulling you to the point where you're not feeling it right afterwards?
Ask me this again. You're asking why is he so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed after he stopped?
What is it, just that he's just not hungover the way the other guys are? That's all that it is? And he's just, because Hawkeye's not normally like this anyway, even when he's not drinking. He's not a get up at 5 in the morning and sing a song kind of guy. So it's like he's almost acting extra, you know, alive, even though we're like, what's going on?
Yeah, I can only imagine that he does probably tie one on right before bed and probably wakes up a little bit later than usual. And so now without that in his system, he has just sort of gotten up. And he talks about the fact, like, the sun is out, there's hot water in the showers, there are all of these things that I've never seen before. And so he might just be like a little bit pie-eyed about the fact that, you know, there's a world that he hasn't experienced in a while.
So Hawkeye is singing to Winchester, and he's singing to BJ. And again, as I mentioned, Alan Alda sings just to me very poorly, and that's part of the idea of that is that. And then Winchester says, "Pierce, you remind me of a dog I once had. He was cheerful in the morning, and we gave him to a family of immigrant Japanese, and they ate him," which is. That's a rough joke.
Again, equal opportunity bigotry from Charles.
Yes, yes. Nobody escapes Winchester's wrath in this episode.
Like, that is just a rough.
Even his own family, as we get to. You know.
But I mean, just even making a joke about killing a dog, tough sell, right? I know that Winchester is not really trying to be funny, but the show is making a joke out of it. It's like, just tough to make that funny, you know?
and that circles around a certain political things that we've heard in the last year or two as well. So,
it has.
It becomes even a little more touchy when you put it in that context as well.
Yeah. It's just like, oof. You know, anytime there's a dog gets killed in the movie, I'm like, well, why did you do that? You didn't need to put that in the movie. Come on, Six. It always bothers me a little bit. So anyway, Hawkeye is thrilled, and he's discovering that there's all kinds of hot water, and he's like, I showered twice. And he's very, very excited. And then Klinger walks in with some mail. And I love when he mentions, he's like, "Sir, you look wonderful." And Hawkeye mentions that I've given up drinking. And Klinger has a great line. "You gave up drinking? I got to call my broker and dump my Seagram stock," which is great gag. And he only has one letter. And he's holding it as Winchester's like, basically, "Why are you? Didn't you say you had mail?" And Klinger's like, oh, yeah, so I got one letter. And he's like, this is for Winchester CE3. And there's a great bit of physical comedy where David Ogden Stiers like pops into the frame behind Jamie Farr, grabs the letter, and then disappears back again. It's very cartoonish and it's very funny because he's like, give me that. And he just sort of disappears back out of the frame. Winchester mentions that it's from his sister Honoria. And BJ's like, isn't that the lady wrestler?
I did think it was funny though, and I, as you know, Charles is all upset that his sister is marrying an Italian, but he apparently was not upset about the fact that in season six she was already married. So I don't know if she was getting married twice or what the deal was.
Yeah, I think they conveniently forgot about that.
I'm sure it was one of those MASH continuity things that's like, nobody will remember that. We're going to write this.
Because he mentions that she ran away. She like ran away, like eloped with somebody. And
a farmer or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And that she was kind of the black sheep of the family a little bit. But they've dropped all that. Forget all that. So he gets his first mention where he's like, they're saying, is she sick? And he's like, worse than that, she's engaged to an Italian. Yeah. And the way that David Ogden Stiers Winchester just spits an Italian, it's just the absolute worst thing ever in history. So it's just really fantastic. So then he runs
How is that? He's Bostonian. And so that was obviously a thing during the Civil War era and a lot of that, but was that really that sort of I don't know, anti-Italian sentiment in the upper classes. Has that been there in the 20th century?
I mean, I will say that, you know, when you get to be like, how do I want to couch this? That there is like old money still in the Boston area that just have what we see in Winchester, which is this complete air of superiority. And I would say that some of those sort of people might not want to be involved with, like, you know, Italians. Like, there was still that, like, what are you, a gangster? Right. You know, that sort of thing. So I'm not surprised. I mean, I think that you could probably Mad Lib in almost any nationality that isn't of some sort of, like, I'm going to assume Anglo-Saxon thing, and he would be upset, like, she's going to marry a Spaniard, a Portuguese man, right? Like,
anyone that's not us,
yes, exactly.
It's always that. It's always that. Everyone who's not, what luck that I just happen to be the only good races, right? What?
Yeah.
Thank for merciful providence that I just happen to be the only decent races. It's like, okay. Now I'll say, growing up, because I don't look Italian, I've been blonde my whole life, and I was generally on the paler side, maybe because I read a lot of comic books. I didn't go outside. I had people in the neighborhood occasionally say stuff to me about someone else in the neighborhood who was Italian in a derogatory sense, not thinking I was part of the secret in crowd. And as a kid, I was a little like, okay. And, you know, I was sort of raised to not say anything about that, because again, my last name doesn't, the Italian comes from my mother's side, so my Irish name is my last name, but I had people say stuff to me, and I was just sort of taught, well, don't say anything and let it go. But I would then tell my parents that, you know, oh, so and so down the street made a knock about Italians, and it was just sort of shockingly casual how that people would feel very comfortable saying that to me, assuming that I was part of the in crowd. And now, I mean, Ange, obviously you didn't have that with your last name. So you did. It was not hidden to anybody.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I grew up in Rhode Island, and Rhode Island was a place where a lot of Italian Americans came over and sort of settled. So there were big chunks of Rhode Island that are just like still very Italo American, but for sure, there's also like an Irish contingent in Rhode Island as well. And I think those sort of like antiquated dislikes sort of still stuck around even in high school. So for sure, I was called Dago, Ginzo, Wop. Like, all of those things were fired at me at some point.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh,
very different from where I grew up in South Dakota. You know, it was The four, the, you know, the, how do I want to say this? The difference in nationality was if you were German, Swedish, or Norwegian. I mean, they were so packed together. They were all sort of the Nordic. There was, they always would, people would tell Polish jokes or different things like that. But I guess I was too naive to even know the difference. I just laughed and went along, and I knew people that were, and everyone told all the same jokes about each other's nationality. They were the same jokes. I don't, they just like, kind of like you said, Andrew, they just erased the one nationality and then put a new one in there. So it was all kind of equal opportunity. I never really thought twice about it. I look back now, and like you said, it's kind of a head scratcher, but
there is no group so small that people in the group can't subdivide it into the us versus them group. Yeah. Right, there could be down to three people and there'll be two that look at the other one of like, okay, I don't know about that one, you know. It's just unfortunately just a unfortunate fact of human nature to a lot of people. So
people try to prop themselves up by hoping someone's lower in the social ladder.
It's eternal unfortunately. So Winchester runs into Klinger's office. Klinger's not there, so he's trying to place a phone call, and he actually manages to place a phone call. They've been running jokes about how nobody else but Klinger knows how to operate the phone, but he manages to bang a bunch of buttons and pull switches, and he gets it going. And of course, he gets frustrated at one point, and he's like, "It's not working. Why should it? Wasn't Marconi an Italian?"
Yeah.
So that's the first, right? That's the, yep. We would count these. That's the first of the just, I mean, bad enough that he said he's an Italian, but this is the first, you know, kind of like prejudice joke about Italians that that Winchester is going to spout in this episode. So he tries to place the call to Boston. There's a running joke where everyone apparently seems to say to him, Massachusetts?
Yeah.
Yes, Boston, Massachusetts, you geographic whiz. And we find out that he is talking to Sparky, who we did see in one episode back in season one, but apparently Sparky's never been rotated home. He's just been operating the phones at I-Corps all this time. I guess it's an easy gig. And, of course, we find out that you cannot just place a call back home. You have to get authorization, and Winchester doesn't know about that. And he says, well, I am a major. And he says, you're a supercilious twit with a name befitting a Cocker Spaniel. And of course,
I'm sure would help get his.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then Winchester, and then Klinger comes in and he's like, I'm trying to call Boston. And Klinger goes, Massachusetts. So again, it's the running gag. And there's even a mention where he says, no, it's spending the time, it's spending the winter in Florida. So, oh, hey, there we go. I got my state here. So there's a great gag where, Klinger picks up the phone. He's talking to Sparky. He says, hey, Sparky, long time no. And then there's this pause, and he kind of lowers his voice, and you hear him go, huh? And he says, I can't talk about it right now. He's standing right next to me, which is...
Yeah.
I like that. I like that joke a lot. So they're going back and forth about, you know, why you can place the phone call. And Winchester says, this is an emergency. My sister has surrendered to an Italian.
Yeah. This is a military emergency. An Italian. He always spits out that Italian word with such inflection.
He really has the facial expression too that goes with it. Just scrunches his face kind of up and like it's a bitter taste in his mouth.
Yeah. Oh, David Ogden Stiers is swimming in for the fences in this episode. And then, of course, he tries to get Klinger on his side by saying, how would you feel if your sister was marrying a swarthy, dark-haired olive picker?
And then after Klinger says, well, my mother did and my sister did and the future Mrs. Klinger will. Well, did I say something to offend him?
Yeah.
Says, well, gosh, maybe, yeah.
Now, okay. I mean, there's no way to know how people take these things other than your own reaction, but like, do you think either one of you, Scott, let me ask you, like, how much humor is being wrung out of the joke is that Winchester's being a jackass versus they're just getting some Italian jokes in there. Like there's a little, you know what I mean? There's always a little bit of like, how much are we laughing at Winchester and how much are we laughing with Winchester?
I think it's 50-50 in there.
You think it's a split?
I think and this kind of goes back to what I asked Ange about, you know, jokes like that. When I grew up, it was Polish. That was during this same time period. That was just stuff that was in the common vernacular. People told ethnic jokes. They just did. So it's something that people would have recognized. And, oh, I remember that one, you know, or something like that. I can hear an audience saying that. I can practically picture my dad chuckling under his breath, trying not to sound like he was chuckling at some of those things. You know, not that my father was racist, but he would have been familiar with those jokes in a sense, too.
Yeah. Andrew, what about you?
I think it's probably 75-25 that we're more laughing at Winchester. There's nothing that we're hearing about this guy. Like, if there was something like, you know, he says he's an olive oil, you know, importer, right? You know,
Jenko. Like,
if there was more stuff about the guy that she's supposed to marry that plays into those stereotypes that become stereotypical jokes, I would say it was a mix. But I think he's just completely overreacting. And so I think we're meant to be laughing at his bigotry. Although there are some things that get said in here that sort of lean into some Italian tropes.
Yeah. I mean, like, I watched 30 Rock. 30 Rock is one of my other favorite TV shows of all time. If I had lots of time to do more podcasts, I would do a 30 Rock podcast. One of the recurring guest characters on that show was Elaine Stritch playing Alec Baldwin's mom. And she was hilarious on that show, just absolutely ruthlessly hilarious. But one of the recurring bits with her was that she was just an absolute racist about everybody. And the show, I would laugh at the jokes because you're laughing at her insane bigotry. But I have to say, sometimes I'm like, I think I'm just laughing at the joke because it's just so unusual, you know, to hear jokes like this on television. And in fact, there's one episode where she confronts her son for dating two women simultaneously. And she's like, what are you, Jack? Italian? I'm like, how much am I laughing with her and how much am I laughing at her? I don't exactly know. So, yes, Klinger gets deeply offended, which, of course, Winchester, think this through.
Yeah.
come on. And I love the look on Jamie Farr's Klinger's face. He's like absolutely, you know, offended to his core. And as you pointed out, Scott, he's like, so did my mother and my wife and my sister. And so will the future Mrs. Max Klinger, whoever she is. And he storms off. And Winchester says, did I say something to offend? Which he just doesn't even understand what he's doing. He then runs into Colonel Potter's tent. He asks to get a special pass to Boston. And of course, with Potter responding, Boston, Massachusetts.
That joke got funnier to me as it went along. I don't know why. Yes. It seems like it should get less funny, but to me, it got more funny as it went because of Charles's exasperation.
Yes.
I think it's the comedy precept of like, you do something a couple times and it's funny, and then you keep doing it and it stops being funny. And then if you keep going past that, it becomes funny again. I think that's kind of what it is, that it's just like, why are so many people asking where Boston? There's only one Boston, as far as I understand, right? There's only one. I mean, where else would it be? So Potter is a kind of like, you come in here yelling at me, and he mentions that he's got his hangover, tying it into our other story. And, He says, you want to spend the rest of your war with a bullseye painted on your back? And he says, I'm sorry, I'm under terrible stress. You see, my beloved sister, Honoria, has betrothed herself. And he's like, Potter's like, oh, so you want to congrats all around? Who's the lucky caballero? And he says, no, you don't understand. The man is Italian. Again, he spits it out. Potter's like, okay, well, then happy paisano, which is...
Yeah.
He got the wrong idea of why Charles was upset. Oh, no, it wasn't because I said caballero.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll change then. You'll be okay, Charles.
Yeah, I'll just change the term. And he says, I know you're willing to be there for the nuptials. And Winchester says, no, I don't want to attend the nuptials. I wish to prevent them. And Potter is like, come again. And then there's this absolutely fantastic joke of Winchester saying, surely as a horseman, you can understand. You do not sire a fine thoroughbred with Tony the Pony.
I actually wrote that in my notes here, too, about that line.
Yes. Yes.
The way David Ogden Stiers sells that. And he actually lifts his one hand up And he's like, Tony the Poet? Like,
yes.
Well, and the fact that he thought of his sister as a fine thoroughbred is it's a little bit creepy in some ways, it's, too. I don't know.
Yeah. And it works because, you know, you could imagine that that could be like a mobster's name, right? You know, like, oh, it's Tony the Pony, right?
Yes, so,
you
absolutely. Know, so
it kind of like works on a couple of different levels for sure.
It does feel like that would be a character in that scene from Goodfellas where they go through all the mobsters with the names Johnny Two Times and Johnny Tony No Nose and Tony. There's one guy called Tony the Wop in that collection, and my wife always goes, "Why is he the one who's called the Wop? I don't understand. Like they're all Italian. Why is he called?" It's like, oh well, you know, it was the mob. So and Potter is like, when you put it that way, I can see your problem. Permission denied. And then he says, consider poor Honoria. She's young. She's infatuated. She's an idiot. And then I love that Potter turns around and he says, look, boy, aren't you being a bit highfalutin on the score? I just love the way he calls Winchester boy. It's so condescending, but it should be, because he's like, what the hell is your problem? And then he has a great little speech where he says, this is America. Remember those words inscribed on the lady with the lamp? I love Colonel Potter, right?
Yeah.
Just love the guy.
Brings it down to the brass tacks. He's not sugarcoating it or trying to make it sound, have too much airs when he says it. He's just bringing it home.
Yeah. And then he mentions, you know, the thing about bring us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, to which Winchester responds, what do you think slums are for?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he exits. That was just
it's almost Scrooge-like, right? It's like, you know, then we'll decrease the excess population. Right? So, it's just awful.
Once in a while, they would give Winchester a line that was, because you like the character, you like David Ogden Stiers in the role, and you've been watching him now for 3 years, you go along with it, and you're kind of like, oh, he doesn't really mean it, but sometimes they would give him a line that I'm like, man, if someone had said that to me in real life, I'd be like, F you, you know? Yes.
For sure.
I mean, that is, you know, woo. And then, yes, as you say, Scott, he storms out. So then we're back to the post-op, and Hawkeye is talking incredibly loud. You know, and there were the nurses are there, and they're putting down the beds, and Hawkeye is upset that he can't get his rounds done. And Margaret says, we change the linens at 11:30 every day, doctor. And then he gets mad at BJ for quote unquote stealing his pen. And we just see that he's clearly going through the early stages of the DTs, right? That's what's going on here. Now, again, Ange, explain what are the DTs exactly? We've heard these, but what is it exactly?
Yeah, you know, you get so accustomed to alcohol that when it's not in your system, your body is reacting to it. And DTs is like the worst, right? DTs is like you're having tremors, you're, you know, hallucinating. Like you think Ray Milan in Lost Weekend, if I can date myself even longer, right, where he's seeing things and he's shaking and sweating and all of that sort of stuff. And so I do think that this is – he hasn't hit that point, but he's probably – he's acting the way I act when I don't have two cups of coffee in the morning, right? Like, what is happening here? What am I smelling? You stole my pen, right? So it's a little bit more. So –
but I mean, what is it? What is the physical? Is it just that there's your nerves are? I mean, what is the physical transfer? It's the
like anything, right? Like when you say that your body has become accustomed to having this in you, such that it's expected to be there. Then you sort of end up craving, and then you sort of like react to the fact that it's not there. So think about people that are like, I am hooked on heroin. I am used to having my opiate, you know, receptors saturated. They're not. Mm-hmm. And now I'm feeling all of this because I'm used to those things being taken care of, and I'm like really much worse from it. So,
and some of those things might be a stimulant. Some might be a depressant. So your moods or the way that you interpret your environment can change based on that response as well.
Okay. Yeah. So it's like you're withdrawing from something that your body is sort of used to. And it's really only people that like truly are. It's interesting to see that he's coming this close to these symptoms, which just sort of tells you how much he has drank.
And some of those, Ange, too, I know, depending on like the stimulant, I know some of the sleep research shows that, and you, because you mentioned coffee, that like caffeine will block the sleep receptors, but it doesn't stop the production of the sleep chemicals. So yeah, you might be awake and now you remove that, all those sleep chemicals hit the receptor, and then you're just fatigued. You're because all those chemicals are still there, but now they're overwhelming the sensors. So you get some of that as well, depending on what the stimulant or depressant is.
Yeah, as I probably should have talked about coffee and not McDonald's earlier, but
apparently,
for somebody that like drinks a significant amount of coffee throughout the sort of the day, I can tell you, like I know, and I'm like, man, why do I have this headache, and why am I pissed at everybody? And it's like, oh, you probably drink some caffeine. So
okay, all right, yeah. I mean, it's like kind of what they talk about for diets, when you should gradually change things, not all at once,
yes,
because then you're yeah, gonna you're pushing your body in ways you probably, and then you're going to snap back,
and
you know,
can't
really
adapt
hard
that quickly.
Right.
Whenever we talk about exercise programs, we always talk about you should never change frequency, intensity, duration at the same time. Pick one of the three, make that modification, then you adjust the other ones at different times. So it's just what you said. You can't totally change everything. Your body's, that's just too much for it to adapt to at any given time.
Okay. I have a friend, actually a guest of this show. I don't want to say their name in case they don't necessarily want me to mention this, but they came to me a couple of years ago and asked me for my advice about how to go vegetarian, because they were interested in going vegetarian. And I said, do it gradually. Don't just tomorrow, that's it. Because I think the change is, especially since their family was not going vegetarian, I'm like, that's going to be really hard on you. So do it gradually. You know, how many meat meals did you normally eat? Well, have one less. And then maybe in a month have a couple, you know, and do it that way. And they've managed to now maintain, like, they're not, I don't think they're like full vegetarian, but they're like 80%. And I'm like, well, that's the way you do it, right? You don't just go like that, because it can be really, really hard. So that all makes sense. That all makes sense to do it. And in fact, Margaret actually points out, because Klinger calls Hawkeye a grump because he's like, he didn't get any mail and he's mad. And Margaret is the one who actually, more than BJ, a little surprisingly, sticks up for him and says he's not doing this to be a grump. It's the body is undergoing a transformation. And she's like,
and she almost encourages him. Like, that's a good thing that you're seeing you're over-imbibing here.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
With it. Stick with it. She keeps saying, you only have a couple more days. Are you sure? You know, stick with it.
Yeah. Klinger is no help. And he says, we should knock him out and give him tell him he needs a shot to fill the hypo with booze. So it's, come on, Klinger. That's not helping at all. Now, of course, Hawkeye is not doing himself any favors by, we see later at night, while BJ is trying to sleep, Hawkeye is doing push-ups, which is incredibly annoying. And because he can't sleep, and he talks about this, boy, somebody could open up an all night bowling alley, I'd make them rich. And of course, here comes Winchester, who is now drunk, and he's speaking Italian when he comes in to talk to his tent mates. And he says, I was shipping Chablis, and Hawkeye's like, what you are is a wino. And so now we have a nice little, you know, a nice little inversion of Hawkeye's trying his best to not drink, and here's Winchester way over imbibing. And then poor BJ is like, hey guys, do you see me in my bunk? Do you see the darkness outside? Those are the unmistakable signs of night. And yeah, you know, why don't you leave the talking to the crickets? And of course, I love that Winchester goes, my lips are seals. He literally, my lips are seals, which is great. So then he sits down and he's singing in Italian and he decides to write a letter to Honoria. Just not a great idea.
Ill-advised, yeah, for sure.
Ill-advised. He does a great drunk. He's not, I don't think he's the best. I always said Loretta Swit was the best drunk on played the best drunk on the cast. But I like, he's like, I must finish this letter to my sister. That's great. So he starts to recite the letter out loud. And he says, the wedding night, which is going to start with, hey, do you take this woman? Oh, Charles. he starts writing the letter, and he grabs a drink actually first from the still, and yeah. then he starts writing the letter, and says, "Dear Dodo," he's writing to his sister, and BJ is interrupting and getting madder and madder about all this, and then he finally says, "This whole letter is yes. it's just really something."
Again. just every line.
Every line of it is just rough.
It's sort of like in the modern vernacular, where they say, you know, when you type your post, don't press send.
Yes.
Or you may have typed it. Don't press send. Don't send that thing. Whatever you may have written, sleep on it. Don't send that.
I await with bated garlic breath the announcement of your firstborn to Honoria and Vito, the big knife machete, a 12-pound, 10-ounce organ grinder.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like hitting a lot of stereotypes there. Just horrible, right? And remember, even before that, as he's drinking the drink, he goes, "This swill will be better than anything that's served at the wedding. Pizza, ravioli, and scungili," which he just sort of like you know, lets it like ooze out of his mouth, the word scungili, right? So
again, with the facial expressions as he says it too.
Yes, but like, you know, a 12-pound organ grinder, right? Like, that's just, you know, that's a real jab.
Yeah.
Pulling the curtain back, you have to think, what are the writers thinking in the writers' room when they're coming up with all this stuff? Like, where is all this coming from? They seem to be fairly adept at writing lots of insults.
You do wonder, right, if you're writing those jokes, how into that do you want to get, right? Because you might be a little like, all right, we're coming up with a few too many Italian jokes. All right, everybody, like, you might want to kind of calm down a little bit on something. But yes, I do love the way Winchester says "scungili." Just says it. Yeah. Like, absolutely, like, it's the worst slop in the world. It's like, it's some pasta. Charles, calm down. It's not that big.
Yeah,
snails, it all sounded right? good to me.
Yeah, scungili is snails, like a snail salad. So,
is that really that what that is?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't think I knew that. Okay. So BJ finally gets so mad because he can't stand that both of his tent mates are arguing, and he storms off, and that is our act break. And then we come back, and Hawkeye is sniffing the meatballs that everyone is trying to eat. And he finally comes up with that it smells like something in a hyena's cage. And he goes, no, wait. And then we do this slow pan out, and we see everyone else sitting there and trying to tolerate what he's saying. And he goes, no, it's the inside of a fisherman's boot in Newark. That's it. The potatoes
slams
on the
fist
other
on the
hand.
Table. Yeah. That's it.
And then Potter is like, son, I think he'd be able to get these vittles down without the nasal appraisal, as he calls it. And this is a thing that Hawkeye's been doing since the first season, and it is one of his least attractive traits, right? Just nobody wants to – just shut up.
We all know it's bad. We don't need to be reminded of it with everybody here.
Yeah, just keep it to yourself. Just keep it. And, of course, he's being sanctimonious because his taste buds are different, and he says – you know, there's a whole world out there, and you have no idea how disgusting it is. And they're all.
What did he say? That the veil of alcohol has been lifted from my brain. He said something like that at some point.
Yeah.
Where he's like, he's viewing things in a whole different way, or maybe the same way, just more of it.
And he also says, one of the lines that I like is that he goes, "You want the old Dr. Pierce from South Korea?"
I laughed out loud at that one too.
That's a word that's been lost to history, right? Nobody says souse anymore. That's not a that, you know what, it's funny, that reminds me, like you were mentioning, Scott, like in terms of like we all grew up, we're all of the age where we grew up with ethnic jokes. Like when I was a kid on the Johnny Carson show and stuff, Foster Brooks was like a comedian that was on pretty regularly. And for anyone listening to this that's not a million years old like us, the whole Foster Brooks's whole bit was that he was drunk. That was his whole shtick. He barely did jokes. It was just that he was a drunkard, and that was his persona. And to the point where Foster Brooks became like code for like a drunk person. And you think about that, like, that's not anything that would work in the last this century. No one could come up with that persona as a comedian. That was just not a thing anymore.
Well, and that was a thing. I mean, look at, like, again, going way back, you look at you know, on the Andy Griffith Show, you had Otis on there all the time. There was always the town drunk. You know, you had that, and you had Dean Martin played that up all time. Yep. How much alcohol he drank, you know, and one of the classics of all time, The Cannonball Run, Rob, which I know how much you love that.
I saw in the theater.
Dean Martin, that was his whole, that was the whole thing through that whole movie.
Yeah.
That was a thing in that, I mean, that drunk character was ever present.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, even in cartoons, right? How often did we see Jerry fall into a bottle of whiskey? Dumbo gets completely drunk and has like a psychedelic trip in that Disney movie.
Yeah. So. It's just, it's funny to think about that. We, you know, it's just, that's not anything that anybody would think is acceptable in the last quarter century. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing that we've gotten rid of it, but it's just interesting that a guy like Foster, I don't even know if that was his real name. Right, but that was like a persona that he put on. I don't know. But that guy could have a career, and, like, you know, flash forward 15 years, and, like, that's not going anywhere. That's not anything he could ever do, you know. But he was a staple. The Dean Martin roasts and stuff. He was always doing that kind of. He was doing those gags. Yeah. So anyway, Hawkeye is kind of really being irritating, and everyone, as you say, does the whole South Korea line, and they're kind of like, he's like, oh, you want me to go back to being the old way? And then finally Margaret says, I understand what you're doing. It's admirable. It's noble. It's an inspiration to us all. But I think I speak for the entire congregation when I say, shut up. And that's when he says, oh, you want me to start drinking again? And that's when he has the line about South Korea. And then she finally says, you know, well, if your senses are so clear, how come you can't figure out that I've been the one defending you? And Hawkeye's like, well, there's no need to get huffy. And she storms off. And of course, Potter is irritated. And then we get Lieutenant Mendenhall, played by Shelley Long, the first of two Cheers cast members that will be guest stars on MASH. George Wendt will come along in the final season. But Shelley Long has a little more of a connection to the show. Not only did she appear in this episode, she, of course, hosts the first MASH reunion special that they did. I think it was the 10th or the 15th. I think it was the 15th. Back when the entire cast was still around, McLean Stevenson and Larry Linville were still around, and so they participate in it. But she hosts it, and there's actually a section in that best of special where she's like, see if you can spot the guest stars, and it's just trip hammering through all the people that guested on MASH who went on to bigger careers. John Ritter and George Wendt, like I just mentioned, and Patrick Swayze and Lawrence Fishburne. And then she says, the first one, see if you can name them all, the first one I give you. And it's her. So that's her connection. And of course, they talk about the date that they're going to go on, and Hawkeye is being all lovey-dovey with her and stuff. And then that leads Potter to say, maybe you could save a little cute for the rest of us, which is a great observation that he can turn it on for Lieutenant Mendenhall, but for everybody else, he's a jackass. So I love that. I like that, you know, he can point that out a little, like, all right, Hawkeye, you can clearly turn it on and off. So then Winchester shows up and he is upset. He's kind of grunting. What are they serving? Of course, Italian meatballs. And he turns one down and he says, no, my sister's marrying one. So there's another.
Yeah.
just a never ending.
Never ending.
And then Mulcahy, Father Mulcahy, who's standing there, says, I have to say, you know, Major, the Italian people have given the world a great deal. Art, culture, the Renaissance. He says, I hope you'll reflect on and try to accept this situation. And then Winchester makes it even worse. But he says, I'm coming close to acceptance when I console myself with the fact that at least she's not marrying an Irishman.
Yeah.
Which, of course, Father Mulcahy is offended by.
Yes,
we've got another one we've found a way to offend here.
Like, does Winchester not does he not think anyone is ethnic of any, like, where did does he all think everyone is just, like, white? Like, where they all come from? We all come from somewhere, Winchester. What are you doing? Mulcahy, what did you think?
and an Irish Catholic too.
Yes. Priest,
for goodness sakes. I did find it funny. It's almost like through this whole thing, Hawkeye is horrible because he's not drinking, and Charles is horrible because he's drunk on his own self-superiority and spewing all this crap out, you know?
I would love it if we had ever learned what Winchester was. Like, what is his background? Because what does he consider the only good ones, right? He's not, obviously, he's not Irish and he's not Italian. So what
he's got to be English, doesn't he?
I guess, right? He probably, probably pure English. And that's because he talks about how much he reveres. Although there was another episode where Hawkeye was complimenting England and Winchester mocked it for their socialized medicine. So, okay, obviously, see, even then, he's just. Yeah. Again, what luck that he happens to be the one race that's any good. Yeah. Just such total luck that it happened that way. So later on, we see Hawkeye and Lieutenant Mendenhall are on the date in the supply room. And we see that Hawkeye is not drinking at all. And he says, I'm having a really swell time. I even had one drink. And Lieutenant Mendenhall is like, it's okay. Is it okay if I drink? And he says, no, that's fine. But then, of course, he can't help himself because he's like, you could go easy on that stuff. And she's like, what? And he's like, well, that's your third glass, but who's counting? Well, okay.
Yeah.
And then she's like, well, it's helping putting me in the mood. And he's like, you need an artificial stimulant to get in the mood. I don't need to get my moods out of a bottle. And we could see that she's still trying. She's like, but you are in the mood, right? And he's like, yeah. But if you need some kind of artificial stimulation just to get in the mood, and he's like, what kind of relationship do people have if they have to get numb just to feel something? And Lieutenant Mendenhall is like, what the hell is going on? And then she finally says, you know, I heard you were warm and tender, great sense of humor. And then she keeps trying, right? She goes back in again and she's like, you know, I understand you're really funny. And he says, oh, sure. I bet after a couple belts of that, you'd say the same thing to J. Fred Muggs. Now, does anyone want to explain to our younger listeners who the hell J. Fred Muggs was?
Well, I have to admit, I had to look it up. So I'll let one of you guys, if you actually knew who he was.
I did know. Scott, did you know who J. Fred Muggs
was? I knew of him. Yeah. But I'll say it. J. Fred Muggs was basically a chimpanzee mascot on the Today Show. I mean, just that right there. Because
that was a thing that happened.
Yes.
and the Today Show started in 1952. And apparently by the time they got 1 year in, they thought they needed a chimpanzee mascot. So that maybe tells you about how the Today Show was going. But that's sort of one of those anachronisms, too. With the Korean War ended in July of 53. And I think J. Fred Muggs started in February of 1953. So that's pretty close to being a little bit of an iffy connection that Hawkeye would have known about him.
But J. Fred Muggs is already part of the popular culture that you could make a reference to it and people would know what it is. Yeah. But yes, the Today Show started with Dave Garraway was the host. And then later on, he had a co-host that was an actual chimpanzee that sat at a desk because that's what television was like back
and apparently the chimpanzee, J. Fred Muggs got sanctioned because he supposedly bit Martha Ray at one time. So I mean, although you just can't make this stuff up. I mean,
I never heard that.
Yeah. But then he did not. Then they said, well, that was all fake for a promotional. And I'm like, okay, now you're having to have good media for your chimp co-host.
Yeah.
I mean, at what point has this train traveled far enough down the tracks? Right?
Wow. Bit Martha Ray is, that's like a Mad Lib sentence, right? The chimpanzee host of underscore the Tonight Show of the Today Show bit, okay, who? Proper name, Martha Ray. Okay, sure. Why not? What the hell? Wow. That I didn't know that. That's fantastic. Thank you, Scott. So that finally does it. That's enough. And Lieutenant Mendenhall gets up and she's like, Dr. Pierce, if you recall, this little tete-a-tete was your idea, not mine. I have to, the way that Shelley Long says tete-a-tete is totally Diane Chambers. And, you know, I don't want to limit Shelley Long and be like, well, she could only do Diane Chambers, but she radiates intelligence. Shelley Long just does. And I think whatever the persona she might have been trying to craft for herself as an actress was clearly already forming by 1980. I mean, Cheers is only 1 year away at this point. Anyway, it started in 19 or 2 years away. It started in 1982. But that's a Diane Chambers, this, that, tete-a-tete, which is a very kind of formal, which you could have said, you know, date. You know, she could have said, you know, whatever. But tete-a-tete is a very Diane Chambers kind of thing to say. And she says, I get the impression we were going to have an intimate romantic evening. But if I had known I was going to get a temperance lecture, and then she swigs the rest of her wine down, I would have made a date with someone more fun, like a cadaver. And then she stabs the cheese that they brought with her knife, which, you know, Hawkeye's being a giant dick. He just is.
For sure.
And what's his end game there? I mean, at some point, I mean, you got beautiful Nurse Mendenhall in the tent there by yourselves. What is he hoping to accomplish by saying all that stuff? It just seems bizarre.
Yeah.
It almost made me wonder if he was attacking himself. Like, all the stuff he's saying, is that how he pictured himself? That's probably maybe looking into it a little more deeply than it was written. But I keep thinking, oh, do you really need that to get in the mood? He's asking himself, do I need that? You know? I don't know.
Yeah.
It is interesting that he really flips to this sanctimonious.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Just 4 days in, we think, right. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's already almost like with a Winchester air of superiority, like, look at how much better I am than you are. Yeah. I'm not drinking. Yeah. And I don't know if he needs to play that up so much to help him resist. Right. Like, you know, I'm going to go to the nth degree, because I don't want to fall back. And so I have to put on this real jerky persona.
Yeah. I mean, they always say that the biggest proselytizers are the recently converted. Those are the people that are the most sanctimonious about it and stuff like that. So he's like, you got to just, you know, chill out Hawkeye a little bit. I mean, my God. So he ruins the date. So then the next day, Winchester is in the tent and Klinger has some mail. And Winchester throws in a little jab where he says, Klinger, my constant reminder that Darwin was right. And I get the way he sort of snaps, the way he says that. And Klinger says, your remarks regarding all swarthy people shall cease and desist. You'll never see this letter from your sister. And Winchester, of course, is, you know, dying to get the letter. And he's grabbing it and Klinger's pulling it away. And then Klinger has one of the lines of the entire episode. He says, not until you say olive skin makes good kin. I still say to this day.
I still say that to this day. And my family says it to this day. That really is like etched in the lexicon. So.
All the small ways that MASH has influenced the culture.
It really is. I love the way that – I just love the way Jamie Farr delivers that. He's just so self-satisfied. I'm skin, but good kid. So, hey, it rhymes. So Winchester grabs the letter. He knocks Klinger to the floor. And then Klinger's like, okay. He's like, fine, I'll settle for a kind word about olives. And then Winchester opens the letter and Winchester goes, oh my God, the wedding's been called off. And Klinger is standing behind Winchester doing their running commentary. And he goes, what happened? Your family have the groom beheaded? And Winchester's not really paying attention. And then he says, no, it was his family intervened. They forbade him from marrying out of their faith. And Klinger follows up with, don't you just hate narrow-minded people?
Twist the knife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then Winchester says he's got to get a wire going immediately. And then right at that point is when wounded arrive. And then we get this sequence where they bring in a patient and it's one of Hawkeye. It's Hawkeye's patient. And they notice that he's still got pants on, which he is absolutely not supposed to have. Right. They're supposed to. You know, you take all the clothes off the patient before you send them in, for God's sakes. I mean, then they never really. Who messed that up? That's a weird little detail that somebody outside would mess that up. But okay, they did.
Yeah. You know, the only thing I have to say, Rob, is I was so grateful that he says the line, like, what is this guy doing with his pants still on? Because every medical person who's watching this is like, what, the guy still got his pants on? Right? So at least they say this was a mistake that happened. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, you know, very rare. Somebody at MASH at the 477 made a mistake. You know, they slipped through the cracks. But anyway, so as Hawkeye is trying to attend to him, we see the guy pulls a grenade out of his pants. And by the way, that is actor playing the North Korean is David Hirokane. He most recently was on Hawaii Five-0, the remade version. And he was also in the 1981 movie Charlie Chan and the Curse of the Dragon Queen. Which, speaking of things that just do not pass muster nowadays, that movie stars Peter Ustinov as Charlie Chan. I saw that in the theater. My dad took me and my sister to see that in the theater. Jeez. But that was a thing that they were selling to people in 1981 of Peter Ustinov basically doing yellow face.
Yeah. I don't know why, but on my streaming queues, I've been getting all these Charlie Chan movies have been coming in there, and from back in the 30s, they were all white people, Caucasians doing yellow face, and I'm looking at that, and again, it is very uncomfortable to watch it, and Ange, as you have said before too, they lapse into the stereotype. It's not even like they're legitimately trying to play an Asian character because they were cast and they got the movie. It's like it's just all stereotype stuff too. It's just cringeworthy.
Yeah, I think the guy that played Charlie Chan in most of those movies, like Werner Oland, he was like Swedish or something. Yeah. It's very unfortunate. But again, the idea that they made a movie in 1981 with Peter Ustinov as Charlie Chan is pretty tough stuff. And so that's unfortunately those are the kind of roles that a lot of Asian actors were reduced to. I'm sure David Hirokane was not thrilled to be in Charlie Chan and the Curse of the Dragon Queen watching Peter Ustinov playing that. But okay. So he grabs the grenade and Hawkeye manages to stop it. And Potter mentions, everyone who doesn't need to be in here, get out. And they're trying to find the pin. And there's this great little line where they talk about they're looking for the pin. They don't know where it is. And Winchester says something like, they tried to put him under and Margaret runs over. And that little sequence of Margaret running over to the guest, the anesthetic and the anesthesia tank it's handheld. It's real jumpy all of a sudden. We've turned into a Bourne Supremacy movie. I don't know why all of a sudden they do it that way, but okay. And she mentions that the tank is broken and Klinger's like, go get an ether mask. And then they decide, okay, we got to put the pin back in the grenade and they're looking for it and they can't find it. And Winchester says, just use something else, a needle, a swab, anything. And then Potter yells, this is no time for experiments. That's a commie pineapple, which is, first of all, great turn of phrase, calling it a commie pineapple. But I like that's a nice, it's a nice reminder that probably, certainly among the medical staff, maybe even in the whole hospital, Potter is the only one with extensive military history. And
especially
he's the one
in that room, and especially in the room. Right there.
And he has to be the one to point out to them, no, you can't just do that. You have to stick the pin. Like, he knows. No, we can't F with this. I think that's just a nice little reminder that Potter's got a different set of experiences than the rest of these doctors. Because if you don't know anything about grenades, you might think, well, I could just stick anything in there and that'll stop it. No, it'll explode and kill everybody. It's a great line read by Harry Morgan.
Yes. And it's true, right? That you can imagine if you put like a Q-tip in, it probably isn't strong enough to stop the grenade. Like, you know, flange from flying open, right? A needle is probably too small. You have to find the right thing to put in there.
And how much jiggle room is appropriate for that thing to not explode either? So you have to have the right diameter, as you said, the right material. Yeah, and you know, that's very, very thoughtful of Colonel Potter.
Yeah, I always like that line. It just was a nice thing of like, Potter, despite being a doctor, Potter's probably thrown some grenades in his lifetime. He served in two wars previous. He knows what grenades could do, and you can't F around with them. I just think that's a great – and, of course, Winchester would know nothing about it. I mean, why would he? Why would he have any experience about that? Now,
you know, in that scene I read in the original script, Klinger was on the floor looking for the pin, and there was a joke in there. Have you guys read – did you guys see that?
No.
Where he picks up an earring and said, oh, this is where I left that.
Oh.
And they cut it out. And probably in that moment, that would not have been a great joke, you know, in a more tense moment. But that was supposedly in the original script.
Interesting. Wow. I think that I actually laughed at that. I thought that was kind of funny. But I can see why you maybe don't want to break the tension of the scene.
I thought it was funny, but I'm like, probably should have plugged that in somewhere else. That moment is breaking the tension of the moment. But
yeah,
it was kind of funny.
Now, speaking of things that break the tension that I don't think work is this scene where they decide to sing the guy, and they sing they start the Mockingbird song Hush Little Baby, and it's just, look everybody, I think I have my bona fides established that I'm a fan of this show. I've done 187 episodes of this podcast. This is too treacly. It's too cute by half.
It's very forced.
It's very forced. They should have come up with another way to come. I understand that they want to do, they're trying to do it in a nice way. They don't want to wrestle him. They don't want to beat him. They don't want to knock him unconscious. They're doctors. But singing to him, A, it's not going to work. And B, it's just, it makes me cringe a little every time the scene
that
comes
horrific up. Singing would have made me more anxious were I on that table.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad I'm not alone on this. This doesn't work for either one of you guys either.
No, not at all. I was giving the screen the side eye as I was watching it, like, oh, really? I kind of put that out of my memory, I think, too. And then I was watching it going, oh, yeah, that's why I didn't remember this. That was just forced. Yeah.
It's just like, no. But it's over relatively quickly. Mulcahy finds the pin. Hawkeye seems to be standing on it. so he grabs it. And then they place it back in the grenade, and they let Mulcahy do it, which is fun. And then they manage to defuse the situation. Klinger comes in with the ether mask, and they get out of that. They get out of that emergency. So then we cut to Klinger's office, and the wounded have been taken care of, and Winchester is finally making a call, and we get one last bite at the apple of the Boston thing, where he says, I want to send a telegram to 30 Briarcliff Lane, Boston. And there's a pause. Yes, Massachusetts. It's kind of exhausting.
And that one really made me laugh because again, we're that exasperation, like, oh, again.
Yeah.
Yes.
Massachusetts. So then he relates this telegram, and he says, my dear sister, an incredibly profound experience has served to intensify the significance of your last letter. And, you know, he says, it made me realize with keen awareness, and you realize that he's telling this to a stranger, of course, who's jotting all this down, how precious life is and the loved ones with whom we share it. You are about to receive several boorish letters, which I deeply regret sending, and please attribute them to the greatness of distance and narrowness of mind, which is a terrific line, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's. I think that's just a wonderful turn of phrase. And he says, I finalized to my shock and shame, they were no longer the naive little sister that I left at home. And, you know, I wish I could be there to share the pain you must feel. And all these scenes that David Ogden Stier did with his sister, who we never hear from until the season 11, where we hear the tape that she's made. But all the phone calls he ever has with Honoria, it's always just him. We never hear her. I always thought these were really beautiful. I don't know if David Ogden Stier had a sister or had a sibling, but he really sells these. He may be talking to a PA on the other side of the line, and they're just saying lines back or whatever. But he Winchester has a tenderness in his voice, not just this scene and all the ones. He has a tenderness in his voice that really sells to me how much Charles loves his sister. And it's very, very sweet, you know? And so I love all these scenes, and it's, you know, I'm glad in season 11, we actually do get to hear from her. If indirectly, but these always work for me. I always thought David Ogden Stier just crushed these every time he got one to do.
Yeah, I thought go ahead, Anshar. Yeah.
No, you go, Scott.
I was just going to say, I agree. I thought he really delivered. I thought David Ogden Stier really delivered there, and it was, as you said, it was the words were moving, especially in light of all the bigotry that he'd had all the way throughout the episode, where you kind of get to what a sanctimony, and then you come to this and you kind of feel for Charles again, like, okay, he is really a decent person somewhere deep down in there. And what, and then again, how he delivered it, I kept watching his facial expressions, and I've said this before when he was saying other things, acting drunk or whatever, but just the little shake of his head or how he closed his eyes to say parts of those lines, I just found really moving. He really, like you said, he's always good in those. I thought he really delivered on this one, though, visually and vocally.
Yeah, and I think the language he uses is clearly like Winchester language and not language that other characters would use. And and it's like you say, Rob, like, I think he is very protective of his little sister, and sometimes that can come out in ways that aren't good, right? Like, I want to make sure she's not rushing into a marriage that doesn't make much sense, so let me just be a complete, you know, jackass about this guy being Italian. And then he realizes, oh my God, you know, the tables have turned. She must be completely crushed. And now I have to go back to being like a loving brother and protective in a different sort of way. I think a lot of it comes from like overwhelming, you know, concern for her, that just comes out in an unhealthy way sometimes.
Yeah. It's really beautiful. I mean, not, you know, pretty tough for some actors to do phone call scenes because they may not be reacting to anybody. Or again, if they are reacting to somebody, it's not an actor probably, you know. Once in a while, you'll hear some story about an actual actor will feed lines because they really want to help their other actor out. But a lot of times that doesn't happen. And David Ansari always just does a just wonderful, wonderful job with it. And then you think about that, he is relaying this very personal thing to a stranger who is jotting it down and sending it to his sister. So then we come to the O Club, and everybody's filing in. I like that Winchester is not in this scene. It's kind of a nice reminder that he's off doing that while they're doing this, and they're all having drinks, and they're all buying ones for Mulcahy because, of course, he was the one that found the pin. And Hawkeye orders a drink, and it makes everybody turn their head. And they're like, Hawk, you know? And he was like, oh, you were so close to finishing. And he's like, look, we almost got blown to Kingdom Come. I need this drink. And then that's when he stops and looks at it. And then in contrast to the earlier scene, they're not mocking. Actually, they're supporting him now. They're actually saying, even Mulcahy says, you were only at 2 days left to go. So they're actually, you know, they want him to do this. Potter says, let the boy make up his own mind, folks. Oh, here he calls Hawkeye boy, the way he called Winchester boy, but it's a more sweet, like, let the boy do it. And then they hand Hawkeye a drink, and he's like, I need this drink. And before he knocks it back, he says, he puts it down, and he says, I'll come back when I want it, not when I need it. And he walks off. Now, it's kind of funny to me. Now, I know that this makes for a dramatic exit, so I get why you would do it this way. But I do feel bad for Hawkeye that he can't sit with his friends and just not drink, right? But I guess the temptation is too strong. But it makes me sad. Like, it feels very lonely that he can't, like, just hang with his homies here, you know, just because he's not drinking. And it reminds me a little bit of a friend I had many years ago who told me that she used to do, in her younger days, she used to do cocaine, and she had all these friends that she did cocaine with. And when she stopped doing cocaine, she had to stop hanging out with them all because they were still doing it. And she was like, I know that if I'm around it, the risk is too great that I will, get caught up in it. And so not only did she have to force herself from doing this pretty dangerous drug, she lost like a chunk of her friends in the process, which obviously probably leads to a lot of people to keep doing those sorts of things. And it just reminded me of that. A poor Hawkeye probably just goes back to the swamp and what? Stares at the tent flap while everyone is having fun. So it's a winner ending in that Hawkeye is doing what he said, but it also makes me feel sad for him.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I do think that if you stay there and they keep drinking, and then you might just say like, well, all right. Like, you know, and I think his sentiment of saying, what we talked about before, want and need, I think is really the difference here, right? You know, if he didn't feel he needed it, he might just say like, I'm ready to start again.
And they all look at each other and smile because obviously they're relieved that he's sticking to it. And then that's the end of the main part of the episode. And then we come back for a little bumper with Hawkeye and Winchester in post-op, and we see the patient that the North Korean is sedated, and there's like Winchester says he's all innocent, like he's almost like he looks like an angel, and they're kind of just having this conversation and talking back and forth, and Hawkeye makes a joke about the guy's clothes, and then we see that BJ is sleeping in post-op, and he's interrupted again, and he gets up and he says, "Is there any place in this cave I can get a decent night's sleep?" And that's the end of our episode. Anything on a little gag that poor BJ just cannot get away from these two, no matter where it is. So that is bottle fatigue. Obviously by the name, they're tipping that the Hawkeye plot is the main plot. But again, I think this one is memorable mostly for all the Italian invective that Winchester throws during this episode. Ange, do you have, before we do favorite line, do you have a particular favorite Italian insult that Winchester lobs in this episode?
I do think Vito, the big knife machete, a 12-pound, 10-ounce organ grinder, is like, encapsulates so many in like the smallest amount of words. So that one in particular, I think, is pretty rough.
Yeah,
I'd chip in, but who am I to argue with you and Ange on that one? I'm going with that. Yeah,
I think. Yeah, I'd have to. I think that one was. That's probably. The olive skin is good. Kin is not an anti-Italian. Just in fact, it's just the opposite. So, but yeah, I think the big knife machete is just. There's even an old film noir called The Big Knife, which makes me think of that. So yeah, it's a good gag. So okay, Scott. Well, let me ask you. Outside of the Italian racism, what is your favorite line or joke from the episode?
I'm going to pick another Charles insult. I don't know why this one struck me as funny at the moment, but it did. When Sparky was on the line with Klinger, and he tells him, "Tell Alexander Dumb Bell instead of Alexander Graham Bell," to, you know, whatever. And that one just struck me as really funny. Again, a totally different non-racial based or, you know, insult or nationality-based insult, but yet Charles with another insult on someone's who he decides is of less intelligence, and it's his fault that he can't get a phone call through. So I don't know why the Alexander Dumbbell just made me laugh.
We know that we did meet Sparky, as I mentioned, in the first season, and Sparky had a very thick Southern accent and was chewing gum and reading an Archie comic or something like that at the time. So you can only imagine what Winchester must think talking to someone, you know, like that. You know, he absolutely thinks this guy must be one level above the aforementioned J. Fred Muggs in terms of who he's got to deal with, you know, and have talked to Sparky. So, Ange, what about you?
I mean, obviously, olive skin makes good kin is like in my lexicon. So I don't think that I can say that's my favorite line. If I had to pick a joke, much like Alexander Dumbbell is one that like is slipped in there and goes away. At the very beginning, when Hawkeye is like, "I just showered and shaved and I'm ready," he goes up to BJ and says, "BJ, let's play golf." And BJ says, "I'm in no shape to drive," right? Like you drive a golf ball. And as somebody who like loves puns, it comes and goes so quickly, but I chuckled out loud. I'm in no shape to drive.
This is a funny episode. There's a lot of good gags. Yeah. There's some good serious stuff in it. And aside from that one scene of the singing, this is a overall really good. And it's when you're tackling a serious issue about drinking, you know, you run the risk of it becoming, you know, the after school special kind of thing. But I think they managed to add enough levity to it. And also to not shy away from the idea that, yeah, Hawkeye was being annoying. I mean, you know, yeah, this is necessary for him, but he was being really difficult to deal with. They weren't shying away from that. And it's like, yeah, that's what could happen to you when you're drinking to that much. So, yeah, it's a great episode. And again, Winchester's Italian jokes are just absolutely for the ages. For me, I already mentioned the joke, but it's when Winchester's so worried about what he reads in the letter and BJ has the whole lady wrestler and he's like, "There's shocking news," and the BJ's like, "Noria lose the big tag team match." Like that's just he's doing that for his own entertainment. I just find that very, very funny. And just there's something about the Noria, right? Losing the tag team match. Like the most kind of like fancy high upper crust name, and then she's the wrestler who loses the big tag team match. This makes me, yes, makes me laugh. So
I really say, poking at Charles. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not as good as, I don't know what season it is, where Radar says honorrhea. It's like gonorrhea. Or but it's a good line.
It's good stuff. So, so that is Bottle Fatigue, everybody. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for coming back. I always enjoy talking to you. And so, Ange, why don't you mention to people where they can find you on the internet?
I'm Dr. Ange 70 on X and Blue Sky and Instagram and now Letterboxd. Yes, and you can find me at my Supergirl blog, Comic Box Commentary, where I do a lot of comic book writing.
Awesome. Scott, are you out there? Is there somebody we can find you?
I am mostly on Blue Sky now, right, is where I am. And then otherwise, I just haven't been doing much content at all. You can look for me on back episodes of various shows here on the Fire and Water podcast network. And one other thing I do want to plug while I'm here.
Sure.
I want to plug getting Dr. Ange an invite to the Supergirl movie premiere.
Oh, every yeah, let's time do that. That
I
yes.
see that. I like it. I repost it. Anything we can do to get Dr. Ange at that premiere, listeners out there, Fire and Water Podcast Network fans, let's get it done for Dr. Ange. The man
deserves. Let's do. We should have done this on the other episode you were on, Ange. But yes, for people who don't know, Ange is like the number one Supergirl fan out there. How long has Comic Box Commentary been going on now?
Believe it or not, it'll be 18 years.
18 years.
More than earned his spot there.
His Supergirl blog can legally drink now, ironically enough.
But only if they want it.
But only if they want it. Not if they need it.
Not if it needs it.
Yeah, Ange is the number one Supergirl fan out there, and it would be awesome. We know that James Gunn is a big comic book fan, and he engages with the fans pretty heavily, to almost to a surprising degree. And so Ange has been trying to get James Gunn to notice him and get him invited to the Supergirl premiere of the movie that's coming out just a couple of months from the time you're hearing this. And that is an absolutely worthwhile effort. We should have done it when you were on the show before earlier in the season, Ange. But yes, we're trying to build the grounds. Well, the Fire and Water Network tends to make things happen. We mention things on the air, and then they sort of just become – They go out in the ether, and they, no pun intended with the medical thing, and they end up happening. So yes, let's get that going, everybody. Let's let James Gunn know that Ange is the number one Supergirl fan out there, and it would be great PR, it would be great marketing, and it would help in case anybody in the theater has a medical issue. We can have Ange right there to take care of them. Yeah. What a story that would be, right? Number one Supergirl fan takes care of medical issue and during the Supergirl premiere. That would be a huge headline.
I want Ange, I really do want you at the Supergirl premiere, but I would have wanted to shoot one further for you where you are an in-story blogger about Supergirl in the actual movie as a extra. I actually think that would have been perfect. I'm serious. I think that would have been awesome.
That would have been a great guy.
Supergirl 2. That's what we're shooting for Supergirl 2.
I appreciate the support, guys.
Yeah, that total worthwhile effort, everybody. So if you find Dr. Ange on Blue Sky and he posts, do you do that every day, the James Gunn thing, or is that every couple days?
Like once a week, once every 10 days sort of thing.
Well, if you see that out there, retweet it, James Gunn, and let's make this happen for Dr. Ange. That would be fantastic. Thank you for reminding me, Scott. That's an absolutely worthwhile effort. So again, thank you both. I love talking to both you guys, and it was great to have you both back on the show together here. Thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can find me on Blue Sky under Rob Kelly Creative. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on the show of your choice. So a big salute to Dennis Bailey, Daryl Clark, James K, Michael Kelly, David Mann, Matt McLean, Lisa P, Brady Palmer, Joe Perino, Stan Peel, Michael Porter, Nicholas Prom, Adam Sanders, Seven Van Schaik, Britt Schramm, Billy Shulman, and Mike Thomas. So again, thanks for the support, everybody. Thank you all for listening once again. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
The sun is as high as a drunken GI.
You know anything from Naughty Marietta?
Nope.
Good. Sing that.